our guests. First of all, their website. Take a look. IBRFINC.org. I know. IBRFINC.org. With Dr. Jonathan Fellis and Dr. Philippe DeFina, we're going to talk about the controversial case of 13-year-old Jahi McMath. Dr. Fellis is currently the Chief Medical Officer for the International Brain Research Foundation, completed medical school training at Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, and completed neurology training at Pennsylvania Hospital in Philly. He also has completed a neurorehabilitation fellowship at University of Maryland Medical Systems Kernan Rehabilitation Hospital, with a focus on brain injury rehabilitation. Also a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Neurosciences at UMDNJ, and sits on the board of directors for the Physicians Advisory Board on the Epilepsy Foundation in New Jersey and the American Society of Neurorehabilitation. Good grief. And has been appointed to the Governor's Panel on Brain Injury Research. Now, Dr. Philippe DeFina, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Scientific Officer of the International Brain Research Foundation, Inc. He spearheads the collaborations among top neuroscientists and research facilities around the world by facilitating and coordinating cutting-edge research. Under his leadership, IBRF is in a position to accelerate the scientific findings that are key to solving the complex issues in the area of brain health. Dr. DeFina is a guest researcher at the National Institute of Health, was a member of the International Neuroscience Subcommittee of the World Health Organization, and has been a pioneer in developing and directing national clinical training programs in the cognitive neurosciences. They join us next, and we'll discuss the controversial case of a 13-year-old girl, Jahi McMath, on Coast to Coast AM. Please welcome to the Bridge of the Mothership our first-time guests, Drs. Fellis and DeFina. Welcome, gentlemen, and thanks for agreeing to be with us at this late hour.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Well, I a lot of people out there are very interested in what you have to say tonight because there's a lot more brain injury out there than anybody would guess. This is not something that's top of mind. With everything else that swirls around in an individual's life from day to day. But when something like this is visited upon you, it becomes your central focus at once. So tell us about yourselves and about the International Brain Research Foundation and what led you to do this work. What interested you originally in the human brain? It's just you and me and a few million of our closest friends. So just let her rip.
Well, the brain is certainly the final frontier of medicine and science, and it is a challenge to all of us who are in that area. I'm a neuroscientist. Dr. Fellis is a neurologist. This organization was developed in 2004 in a very interesting way. I was working at the NYU School of Medicine in the Brain Research Laboratory, and we had a patient who was in a persistent vegetative state due to a surgical procedure that went wrong in a hospital in Virginia. And that individual was in this state for a prolonged period of time, well beyond what the American Academy of Neurology concludes is a time for recovery.
Yep.
So we had taken on this individual with a theory of being able to reorganize electrical and chemical functions of the brain and started this process of taking on this major responsibility to see if there was any possibility of reversing this damage and this state of unconsciousness, which most people refer to as deep coma. But essentially, it's more correctly called persistent vegetative state.
Yeah.
And we were able, over the duration of a year, to reverse this state and to bring him back to consciousness, which started the the whole process of further developing this treatment protocol. And our foundation actually was an offshoot of that work, because a lot of the monies given to the university were used for different projects. So over 50% of any donations would be in a general fund as opposed to specific to this research. So the individuals that made the initial donations asked if we can set up a foundation which only 10% would be used for general administrative overhead costs and the rest directly for the research. And that's what started the International Brain Research Foundation. Since then, we've worked with over 100 people and had a tremendous success rate in improving or recovering individuals who were not recoverable and were told could never improve. So this is what gave us the impetus to continue this work and develop these protocols. And over the last several years, we've been able to publish in well-established peer-reviewed journals. And also, we were able to get an FDA approval, which is very difficult for this protocol as a research tool to be able to be used to further develop the types of things that we put together to enhance brain function.
Okay. Well, that's pretty amazing. Now, forgive me, but now who was just speaking? Because I can't see.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Phil DeFina.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. CEO and Chief Scientific Officer.
I gotcha.
I'll pick up the thread where Phil left off, Dr. DeFina left off. And as a neurologist, I became interested in brain injury rehabilitation during my training, and was more and more interested in pushing the boundaries of recovery, going where no one really wanted to go or had gone before, and continuing to look for creative and hopeful combinations of treatments and therapies, putting together things in ways that people hadn't considered or attempted, and just periodically, just little by little over the years, becoming more experienced and bolder in approaching these disorders that people really consider totally unsolvable, untreatable. That's not the only thing I do, but it became an area that was more and more fascinating to me. And as luck would have it, someone asked me what I thought of what DeFina's group was doing at the time at NYU, and we immediately hit it off. We realized that they had developed a lot of techniques and had a lot of ideas and people and collaborative individuals they were working with all over the world already. But they didn't necessarily have the access to the population of patients. So I was a director at a major rehabilitation center, a place that was ranked number 2 in the country at the time. And I was as director of that brain injury program when I reached out to him, and then his group reached out back to me, and we realized that we really should collaborate more closely. And then this was some 8 years ago. We realized, well, let's pool our ideas, if you will. And that's been really the genius of Dr. DeFina and his group, is to draw upon the expertise and ideas and treatments that are thought to be reasonable by people across the world, across the country, and across the world, and pull them together as needed to tackle some of the most difficult and challenging cases that there are.
Now, when we talk about brain injury, is it primarily, is the injury that you deal with primarily the result of, well, I was going to ask if it was mostly blunt trauma.
Yeah.
But in this case, what happened to Jahai exactly? I know it's a tonsillectomy that went wrong, but what happened to her to put her in this condition?
Well, there's two basic kinds of brain injury that we lump together under a larger term called acquired brain injury. So basically anything you're not born with, something that happens to you is what's called acquired brain injury. We break that down into traumatic and non-traumatic. Traumatic would be war injuries, typically assault, sports injuries, falls. And non-traumatic brain injury, the most common type would be the type that Jahai had, which is a lack of blood flow and or a lack of oxygen to the brain. And obviously, in older folks, that comes from things like a heart attack, cardiac arrest, or drowning or respiratory arrest in any age group. And then in younger individuals, it would tend to be from some medical mishap or an asthma attack or some other reason, such as an individual we worked with who was struck in the chest with a baseball and stopped his heart. So in the case of Jahai, she had this post-tonsillectomy, post-operative complication where she had excessive bleeding. And then as a result of the excessive bleeding, she had a cardiac arrest, and so that the brain didn't get the blood and oxygen. And as we know from the reports in the media, within a couple of days, the hospital had pronounced her as being brain dead.
I see. So non-traumatic injury could also be, I mean, this may not be your thing. And of course, if it isn't, and I'm not going to pursue it. I don't want to go too far afield here, but brain injuries can result from drug use. I understand in some cases this can result in acute schizophrenia, things like that. Is that also in the brain injury category, or is that somewhere else?
Well, technically, if it's truly, truly linked to some sort of substance abuse and the brain goes awry after that, you can't always be 100% sure that person wasn't going to develop, say, schizophrenia before, but it is a bit far afield. We're more interested in, direct damage to the brain that results from, it could be a drug overdose that causes someone to not oxygenate their brain or properly. So, but I wouldn't go into the schizophrenia field because that gets into more psychiatry. But if there's obvious damage in the brain or even subtle damage that can be detected from more specific testing, then that is our area that we deal with. Again, the full spectrum of problems. It's just that something like brain death really grabs the headlines.
You know, I read a story time's going by so fast now, it's liable to have been years ago. It certainly wasn't weeks, but there's a kid in Asia, and the report stated that this person actually had no brain, but was actually a prodigy at math. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. What is the brain? I know it's this squiggly thing, and you know, we've seen it in the horror movies. I remember The Fiend Without a Face and all that. There's a bunch of brains with spinal cords wandering around attacking people. It's ridiculous. But anyway, that's what it looks like. See, this is your brain right here. I guess what I'm trying to get at here is how much of the brain can be physically damaged and still come back. In other words, what is that thing? I know it's nerve endings and synapses and all kinds of effectively electrochemical circuitry. But is there something beyond that that is?
John, that's a great question. First of all, just to put things in perspective, we have in our heads 100 billion nerve cells, neurons, and we have probably 4 or 5 times more support cells. Those are more cells than there are grains of sand on an average beach, just to put it in perspective, and more cells than are than stars in the galaxy. So it is just an amazing, insurmountable amount of cells. I mean, this is just a phenomenal amount of neurons in our head, and the interconnections run into the trillions and quadrillions. So mathematically, it's an amazing, complex system, and there can be damage to multiple parts of that system or major components of that system. And the brain may still reorganize and overcome a lot of this damage. And an interesting case in the literature from England, probably a decade and a half or so ago, was an individual who had very severe headaches. And in the social medicine system in England, you don't just go and get an MRI right away. You go through a whole process of being examined neurologically for your headache, and eventually this individual did go for an MRI. This was a high-functioning executive in a large corporation. And the astounding data that was gleaned from the MRI was that he was an anomaly of medicine. His brain, literally, was the size of a walnut. The rest of the space were these support cells and cerebrospinal fluid, but yet he was able to function as a high-level executive. So that question is a phenomenal question, and we really don't know the limits of what damage can be recovered and what level of brain functioning can make us human and have full cognition and personality and sense of humor, et cetera. And this is the frontier that we're embarking on and things that we're looking at. So that's really at the heart of the question, I think, that you're asking, which is something that we're still not sure of and science is still exploring.
Well, all right, then let me ask you this, because I know that there must be, and I know that as scientists and doctors, you're kind of, let's just stick with the facts here. But of course, there's a certain dream aspect to it. To lead you to this work, there must be a lot of, now wait a minute, what if? What if this? What if that? Would anybody take a shot at this? What is consciousness?
Well, I've been, closely following a lot of the controversy and theories, and dating back to when I was in college, I began forming my own idea, and it's pretty close to what's been articulated by some of the best, which is, you wake up in the morning, you look at the clock, and you suddenly think about what you have to do, and all of a sudden that resonates with emotions and anxieties and goals, and before you know it, your head, your mind is swimming with ideas, and it's checking what the body is feeling, and the body is sending messages to the brain, and the brain is deciding what to do and prioritizing and organizing. So it's really this kind of this harmonic kind of resonation, this interplay and this communication between mind and body and environment and surroundings that then it gets processed and causes you to do one thing and then the next and the other, as opposed to doing the other three possibilities. And you walk through life and you have experiences, and those experiences are registered, and you have memories, and you have interconnections with other people, and you gradually build up this storehouse of experiences that becomes your mind. And so that mind, and we have a unique ability to be aware of our mind, so we believe there's somewhere some network that is needed, some threshold of a network that is needed to consider what it is that your own mind is experiencing in the moment and in the past and thinks about in the future. So that's a very short answer on my best, not guess, but my best kind of amalgamation of our own ideas, our team, and what we've thought through in dealing with individuals, combined with other people's theories of what's out there on the latest thinking about and research on what is the mind and consciousness.
John, this is Phil DeFina. I think Dr. Fellis is really hitting on a main area of awareness and the individual experience or feeling state, being able to pay attention to what's going on outside of oneself, the whole capability of wakefulness, having a sense of who you are in relation to the environment, being able to perceive by hearing, seeing, smelling, etc., what's going on, and having purposeful capabilities to interact appropriately with that environment are all part of this complex consciousness.
Excellent. All right, we must take a little break. We'll have breaks frequently, so let's get ready to discuss the protocol and who can benefit from it as we carry on through the night with Drs. Fellis and DeFina on Coast to Coast AM. And we're passing a few hours tonight with Dr. Jonathan Fellis and Dr. Philip A. DeFina. And we'll discuss the advanced treatment protocol for coma and vegetative state. And I don't know about you, but I would like to know the difference between coma, vegetative state, and this thing called minimally conscious state, of which I've been accused of being in off and on over the years. But I digress. This all revolves around the controversial case of 13-year-old Jahi McMath. So when we come back with the good doctors, we will find out if they were actually able to see her. And any thoughts they may have about being able to restore her. And most importantly, keep the proverbial plug from being pulled on her. It's a potentially tragic story, as many have experienced in their own families. And potentially an opportunity for a real triumph. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Okay, doctors, let me ask you. According to this article I was reading from earlier, you had planned to go out to where Jahi is, and were you able to do this?
Well, we've been in discussion with her attorney, and I have talked to the mother. At this stage, we're involved with her on a level of sort of consulting with and advising, and we hope to work more closely with her in the future.
I see. I'm getting the sense you can't really say much more about that at this time.
We're going to respect wishes of the family at this point, sure.
We very carefully reviewed records, and they're very interested in pursuing what we've already done in other cases. So that's essentially where things are going.
I understand there was going to be some drastic measure taken on the 7th. Has that been put off a little while, or are we not at liberty to say?
That's more of a legal issue. As far as we know, that's still the binding date, but that's not our immediate concern.
Gotcha. All right, good. Well, tell us about your advanced treatment protocol. And really, maybe even before you get into
I'll give you the difference between the different levels you mentioned, coma vegetative, then Dr. DeFina will talk about the protocol.
Read my mind.
So, yeah, real briefly, everyone thinks of coma. Not as many people like to mention the V word, the vegetative state. Coma is when your eyes are closed and you have no awareness of yourself or no detectable, by conventional means, no detectable awareness of yourself or the world around you. Once you open your eyes, technically, that signals the end of coma. And so typically after brain injury, acute brain injury, coma usually doesn't last more than 4 to 5 weeks at most, because the eyes, if you survive through that period of time, then the eyes will generally open. Once the eyes open and you're still not aware of yourself or others or can't demonstrate any awareness, you're considered to be in a vegetative state, although the newest terminology would tries to be more descriptive and avoid the V word, because, of course, and media outlets will also tend to avoid the V word, as I like to call it. They'll stick with coma. Even if someone's been unresponsive for 7, 10, 20 years, they'll still say they've been in a coma for that long, which is not technically true. So the more recent terminology for vegetative state is the unresponsive wakefulness state, or UWS. And that hasn't really caught on yet, except in real academic circles. And once you then, God willing, evolve to a state of being somewhat conscious or aware, or at least being able to show evidence typically of, say, command following, even if it's intermittent command following but definite, then we say you're in a minimally conscious state. And even that term has only been carved out in about the last 15 years and only been more widely used in the last 5 to 10 years. And then if you're able to progress beyond that, then you're more reliably conscious, where you're able to follow more complex commands on a much more regular, reliable basis. Brain death goes back to, go all the way back to coma where we started, and then go one step below, or many steps below, as some might say. Controversy is there. But brain death would say that unlike being in a coma or vegetative state, where your brain stem, the stalk of your brain, like the trunk of a tree, provides the very basic, what are called sometimes has vegetative functions, say breathing, blood pressure control, heart rate control, temperature control, these sort of very basic fundamental features of the brain that help regulate the body. When those functions are wiped out, then you're considered technically, according to the current terminology, to be brain dead, which means your brain can't even support the most basic function. Unlike coma vegetative, where most of those features, at least eventually, if not at the beginning of the injury, eventually they come around to. So most people in coma or vegetative state end up coming off of a ventilator, for example, a breathing machine, because at least that basic part of their brain, the brain stem, can function in that regard in coma and vegetative state. So I'll hand it off to Dr. DeFina then to talk about.
Thanks, John. That was really comprehensive. I want to expand a little bit on that as well. I mean, it's these terms, as Dr. Fellows was saying, are used interchangeably and intermittently by people in the lay, you know, population, and sometimes physicians as well. So the most important thing is that when we have what we call disorders of consciousness as a category, and we'll hold brain death aside for now because there's so many complex components to that. But with coma, the state that Dr. Fellows was describing, where the person cannot be aroused, their eyes are closed, they're unresponsive to pain, to sound, to touch, to light, and they may require a respirator, you know, to breathe at that point in time. Is this damage reversible or irreversible? This is a question that we have to visit and, I think, discuss through this time period. After the four-week or so period, when the eyes become open and they're vegetative, again, these individuals are unable to be awake and aware, although, you know, they're in a different state, a slightly higher level than the prior comatose state, but they're still no longer functional.
If I can interject, that would be like a Terry Schiavo, who was in a vegetative state, and there are these general periods of wakefulness and sleep, so the brain begins to go into that very basic pattern of being asleep sometimes and awake sometimes, and that's in the vegetative state. Sorry, go ahead, Dr. DeFina.
No, please. That was great. Now, locked-in syndrome, we didn't even talk about,
right,
which essentially is another complex variable of consciousness in which an individual may seem like they're brain dead or vegetative, but in essence, the patient is fully aware and awake, but can't move or communicate verbally due to complete paralysis of nearly all the voluntary muscles in the body, except usually for the eyelids, where they may be able to do blinking in response to commands. So this locked-in syndrome is another aspect of disordered consciousness, which individuals may be in a state where presumably you would think they are not aware and awake, but totally are. However, they look either vegetative usually vegetative or potentially comatose. The interesting thing on this, John, is that 35 to 50% of individuals that are in these categories of coma, vegetative, minimally conscious states, locked-in syndrome, there is an error rate of between 35 and 50% in diagnosing the specificity of what actual state they're in. So this is something that the public needs to be aware of, that oftentimes the reliability of the diagnosis is in question. And rating scales and observations are used in light of individuals' experience and the history of what occurred that put them into that state, which helps that clinician try to isolate and understand these levels of consciousness. But there's a large error rate. So this gets into what we started to do. We wanted to look more directly at brain functions than just observational states of individuals who look very similar. And unfortunately, diagnosed incorrectly a third to half the time. So,
what is the reason for this, doctor?
I mean, well, because the brain is not actually assessed as part of this process. And looking at chemical activity and electrical activity and blood flow, et cetera, in relation to some of the clinical components, there needs to be a better integration of history, observation, the clinical tools we use to evaluate, where we make inferences about how the brain functions, and then to look at technology that gives us the capability to actually directly assess these functions vis-a-vis electrical, magnetic, and chemical activity. And those three realms are how the brain functions. It's an electromagnetic environment that's driven by chemical and metabolic activity. So there's a very complex medium in which the brain functions. And if that electrical or magnetic system is somehow disrupted, or the chemical or metabolic system is somehow disrupted, these various states of disordered consciousness will emerge and persist. And without proper diagnosis and strategic intervention, there's little hope for recovery. And that's essentially what pushed us to the limits of trying to better understand some of that science, and to be able to integrate it in a way that would give us more valid and reliable capabilities to understand these states. So number one was trying to put together a comprehensive assessment process.
Yes.
And then from that, direct activities that would enhance that environment electromagnetically, chemically, metabolically. So essentially, we can use things like EEGs, brainwave tests, and more sophisticated forms of those called quantitative EEG and what we call evoked potentials, where we look at various activation states of different waveforms that emerge when there's auditory stimuli, visual stimuli, etc. And we're able to really delve into this electrical apparatus in the brain. And then there are other techniques where we can look at the chemistry of the brain. Various types of specialized MRI, like MRI spectroscopy. You could use PET technology, positron emission tomography. You could look at the interconnections of the brain by looking at special MRIs that look at the connections. Then the fancy name for that is diffusion tensor imaging. So we're able to take technology and understand these various components of what the brain is. It's electromagnetic, it's chemical, it's metabolic. Once we determine where the strengths and weaknesses are in the system, then we go to the treatment, which Dr. Fellis has been a maverick in taking this information from the diagnostic component I talked about into the realm of treatment. And I'm going to let him talk a little bit about that. I just want to finish off by saying we use electrical and magnetic stimulation. We use chemical intervention with drugs and nutrients. And we are able to combine these in ways that will change the environment and normalize the environment as best we can in order to bring back function, to recover function.
When you say normalize the environment, I don't mean to be slow here, but I am when I start talking about brain function with two doctors, okay? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by environment? Which environment? The brain's environment?
The brain's environment. The complexity of this management of complex electrical and magnetic capabilities that need to be maintained, and chemical and metabolic activities, which work together to create this electrical and magnetic state. There has to be a balance within this whole internal environment of the brain in order to manage these functions and to maintain these complex functions. So we wanted to figure out, well, hey, how do we measure all of these complex variables of electrical, magnetic, and chemical activity? So we started to put together specific tests that would give us very, very discrete information about those particular components and to understand what are the normal ranges of electrical and magnetic activity, chemical activity, et cetera, and then how do we bring back those components into a normal range based on the fact that they're, you know, dysfunctional at this point. So we decided, well, hey, if they're electrical and magnetic, and we can measure electrical and magnetic activity, we could also use different FDA-approved instruments to change electrical and magnetic activity. And these are all non-invasive. Then there are the drugs, there are the nutrients. So a complex capability of trying to understand which of these components of that internal environment are out of whack, so to speak, and how do we bring them back?
So we call those each into the discrete measurements and individual pieces of information. We would call those, not just we, but they're widely known in neuroscience and neurology as being neuromarkers. So a neuromarker is something that gives you an indication of where that person is on the range of normal or abnormal function. And then we attack those different neuromarkers that are out of whack and try to get them as close to being in whack as possible. We bring them, so by when we say normalize, we obviously can't fully normalize a brain that's been devastated. But we can move each individual neuromarker as best we can with the tools that we have in a comprehensive, coordinated way in the direction of normalization.
And reorganization.
And reorganization, which sets up the brain for the best potential, the best possible potential to take over its normal functioning on its own. It's like if you fine-tune your car or you give it a tune-up, you give it the best chance for being a high-performance vehicle. So you, just like a team of racers, will tweak and adjust and you try to get the most out of their car, so too will we with the brain. It's just that what sets us apart and makes us the only one in the country, certainly the only one in the world doing this, is that we bring to bear all these different tools simultaneously, and we layer them on gradually, and as we see the different abnormalities during testing, we begin to introduce and layer on and cumulatively accumulate each of the different approaches to the techniques, the chemical with medications, for example, metabolic by supporting the brain's fuel. If you want your vehicle to perform as a high performance vehicle, you want to make sure there's very high test fuel in the tank.
Sure. All right. I'll tell you what, gentlemen, let's pause, do some news and a few other things, freshen up our teas and so forth. And then when we come back, I want to hear the rest of that, of course. And then I have some questions about magnetics. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back.